It's Lois Austin today. This is Monday, March 8th, 2004. All right, Ms. Austin, first tell me a little bit about your background, where you're from, and that sort of thing, and then we'll move on.
I was from Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. Seven generations lived in Washington. I met Bobby in Washington. Now, he had only one kidney due to a freak accident, a prank, really. Children wanted to brush him off the running board of a car, and there was a telephone pole behind it. And it split his kidney wide open. And he nearly died because he had rare blood. And there was only one man in Athens that they could find that had his blood. So that was the beginning, but he could not be in the service because of one kidney. They, even with a, what they say, that you won't charge, and what they have a word for that, a special case, in other words.
I know what you're talking about.
And he tried. He was at Harvard Law School at the time, and when December 7th came, he drove all night to come home to enlist, but they would not take him, even with this special thing. So he came to, well, first he graduated from Harvard, then he taught law school at the university for 1 year, and then that was boring, so he went to Washington and worked for Senator George.
Let me back up just a minute. Was he born and raised in Athens?
No, he was visiting his grandmother who lived in Athens.
Where was he born and raised?
Bobby was born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia.
That's part of the Troutman family.
That's right.
Is this picking up
whole
all right?
Family was Georgians, but his father was born in Rome, Georgia, or that area, and his grandfather was a Methodist minister, and they moved around, you know how they used to move them every 2 years or something. So it was, they were all over Georgia. So anyway, we met in Washington, and it was very interesting. 4 or 5 months that we went together. I met a lot of different people. And we married in February of 1945. And that year, this is something that you don't know either. I didn't know it. The first year of our marriage, he wrote and with the help of Senator Ferguson of Michigan, put in the CIA. It was Bobby's idea because he had many friends in the service. Malin Courts was one who was Admiral Denfeld's aide, and Billy Ward, numerous Atlanta people were in the service, and they kept complaining that there was no interplay between the services for the security. That if we knew so-and-so in the Army about such and such a person, we didn't tell the Navy about it, you know. And it was just incomprehensible to Bobby that here we're all fighting a war, and we've got another war going on between the services. So he said, what we need is one central intelligence gathering, which we could then all contribute to and take out the information. So he spent a year of his life doing this without compensation, and Senator Ferguson believed in it so much he ran it through the Senate, and of course it is a reality now. Whether that's good or bad, I don't know.
Well, now I was going to ask, what was he, did you know what he was, what was he doing in Washington during the war?
He was working for Senator George in the
right.
post-war planning
right.
committee.
Okay, right.
And therefore he had a great entree into a lot of things,
right.
a lot of people. And
Yeah, on the one of the articles that I read mentioned that he was on this committee for the post-war reconstruction of Europe. Does that ring a bell or something like that?
I think
or
the post-war planning committee.
Yeah, it's probably the same thing.
Everything.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah,
you
I'm
know.
Sure that was it. Yeah,
I don't
yeah,
know.
Yeah, uh-huh.
But that's all I knew.
Yeah,
he was in, and I did not know what he was doing the first year we were married.
Uh-huh.
That he. If we, in our apartment, if he was having a meeting, I had to go. I had to be gone.
Mm-hmm.
And then many times he would leave and I wouldn't know where to contact him. So
that was because it was a secret?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, there.
Very secret.
There.
OSS, does that ring a bell? The Office of Strategic?
I knew people
that
who were in that, but that was called the Army, I think. OSS. See, this is what I'm saying. They
mm-hmm.
did not have any interplay between the two
right.
services
mm-hmm.
of what their
mm-hmm.
agents were finding out.
Well, it's in this interview, that's a taped interview. Where did you say that is?
The Kennedy Library.
The Kennedy Library.
The Kennedy Library for that, yes.
Would that include the history of the CIA, or would it be in
no,
there?
I don't think
you
so.
Don't think so.
We'll.
The funny thing about
yeah.
that, when my youngest
okay.
son went to Washington, he had a master's degree in political science. And so he thought, well, you know, he's looking around for a job. So he said, I think I'll go to CIA. And they said, I'm sorry, your father started this, and that would be nepotism to give you a job.
Mm-hmm.
Can you
that's
believe
my goodness.
But anyway.
So after that, what happened after the, how long did he work for Senator George? How long did that
Well, happen? He worked, I can't tell you exactly because I only know when I knew him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but I mean after that, but when did he stop working for Senator George, I guess?
When he stopped working for Senator George is when he went into this background business
right, okay.
for CIA.
Right, okay.
So he didn't have any more
okay.
connection with Senator George, actually, this is, as I say, he was
right,
not paid
right,
for this.
Right.
He had no income during this time, and
mm.
I didn't know it.
Mm. Yeah.
Any of these men alive, Madeline Courts or Billy Wardlow,
no.
They're all deceased? Huh?
No, all of them are gone.
All
of these people were a good bit older than Bobby.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And he was only 26 years old
yeah.
when he was doing all this.
Yeah,
fantastic.
You know,
mm-hmm.
so.
That
it,
would be what period of time? When?
1944.
44 to 26.
Huh?
Uh-huh. Senator
Ferguson. That's a connection.
That's
yeah, we'll check that. Yeah.
Yeah.
After that, what did he do after he emerged from this secret?
We moved to Georgia.
Moved to Georgia, I guess, for you.
Yeah.
yeah. Back for him too, for you.
That's right. It took me away from my family on
yeah.
the eve. Well, it wasn't the eve, but about 3 or 4 days before Christmas.
Oh my!
So,
that was. I know that had to be tough.
I have a story to tell you, which I don't want to be on that.
Oh gosh!
My first experience of being moved to Georgia.
Oh,
but anyway, then he went to work for his father's law firm, which was then Spalding, Sibley, and Troutman.
Okay. Okay.
And needless to say, he resigned from that
mm-hmm.
Because one of the unique qualities of Bobby was that he hated to be in controversy.
Hmm.
And if you're in controversy, you better not be in the law practice.
That's for sure.
That
yeah.
is controversy uh-huh. always. And I never in 46 years of marriage did we ever have an argument.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. What was the controversy there at King's Parliament? Was that the Pope McIntyre? He was one of his partners.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Was there anything in particular, or was it just that he just generally didn't like
he did not
litigation?
Like the law practice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the only reason he became a lawyer was because of his father,
mm-hmm.
and he
mm-hmm.
admired him so, and everybody did.
Mm-hmm.
What was his father's name?
Robert Batty Troutman Sr.
Okay.
He was Robert Batty Troutman Jr. Mm-hmm.
It was H.D. He was a what?
That was his Uncle Henry was Mr. Troutman's brother.
Okay.
And they started practicing law together, and then one went with Troutman Sanders, and Mr. Troutman's firm, Spalding, Sibley, and Troutman, were representing Coca-Cola and all these. So they split up, going to different
and that's
firms.
Bobby went with
and Bobby went with his father's firm. Mm-hmm. So.
What did he do after he left?
Well, that's when Jack Kennedy. See, he had been friends of Joe Kennedy.
Right.
Bobby was ahead of himself in school. Mm-hmm. He had skipped. I always teased him. He was so bright. But I said, "You never graduated from high school," and he didn't. He, after this terrible accident, he couldn't go to school. This happened in the summer, and he couldn't go to school until after Christmas. And so his father sent him to Georgetown Prep, which is in Washington. And Mr. Spalding's son, Husey Jr., was in Georgetown Prep. And so they took him there. So he went to Georgetown Prep for that half a year, and then the next year, and then he would be a senior the following year, and the summer he took some tests and all, and they accepted him in the university. So he went into the university from junior in high school.
Okay.
So
he went to University of Georgia?
University of Georgia. Was a Phi Beta Kappa and all the things.
And then went to Harvard Law School.
Then he was accepted in Harvard Law School and went up there. And that's where he met Joe Kennedy. And a very unique thing happened with that, too. It's just not important for this. But when the war was declared, Joe Kennedy, of course, had to go. Mm-hmm. And he had Joe Kennedy and
Jack?
Randy Hearst and Bobby were all great buddies. Well, Joe left. He gave his record player to the other one.
Randy Hearst.
Uh-huh. And then when Randy Hearst left, he gave it to Bobby. So when Bobby left Harvard, he brought it home and he took it out on their farm. Mm-hmm. One day Randy Hearst, who married Catherine Campbell here, was out at the farm with Bobby and they were getting lunch, and Bobby said, "Go put a record on that record player." And Randy went in there and said, "No, it was the other way around. Randy had it first and gave it to Joe, and Joe gave it to Bobby." And Randy said, "I used to have a record player just like this, but I gave it to Joe Kennedy." So Bobby said, "Well, it's made the rounds."
Oh, my.
Well, anyway, he visited down in Hyannisport with the Kennedys, and he dated Kathleen, who was the oldest mm-hmm. one there. He always went with people older than he was, but he married me, and I was younger than he was. So, but anyway, they just had a good relationship. So in 1957, I guess it was, when the convention, they had a man from Tennessee.
Keefe Offer
mm-hmm. was running against him. They had opened the convention for the vice presidency.
Right, that's right.
And so Jack Kennedy called Bobby on the phone and he said, "I'm thinking of running for vice president. What do you think my chances are in the South?" And Bobby said, "Well, a rich Catholic Yankee. I don't know of anything worse."
This was in 56.
This was in 57.
Yeah.
And I think that was anyway.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So he said, "Well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll go to see Senator Russell And Marvin Griffin was governor at the time. He said, I'll go see Marvin Griffin, and I'll go see Senator Russell, and I'll check around all my buddies, and I'll see what your chances are. So he did. He went to see Marvin Griffin. And Marvin said, well, I tell you, I'd rather have a rich khaki Yankee Catholic than a turncoat from Tennessee.
I love it.
So Georgia went for Kennedy the whole convention. It never, ever went for Kefauver. So, but he got enough votes with Tennessee when they got down to the end of the list that it made, well, that was the best thing that ever happened to Jack Henry.
Right.
Because he got all the publicity, he was the white knight in shining armor. And so we decided, and Bobby talked to him and said, look, Jack, all these people from Georgia went for you. They went down the line. And I think you should come to Georgia and thank us, all the delegates. So he said, I think that's a very good idea. I would like to go. So we decided, it was, you know, 1957, blew the Bible Belt laws and so forth, no whiskey and Sunday and all this. And so we said, well, we can't afford that anyway, because there are a lot of these people. And so the Dinkle Hotel, Bobby represented Mr. Dinkle, so he said he'd give us a room. And we'd just have, you know, punch and cookies and things like that. So we decided the Sunday afternoon would be the thing, because then there was no chance of anybody saying, you know, anything about alcohol. Mm-hmm. So we decided that we'd only invite the delegates and not their spouses, because it was small, you know, we didn't have the facilities like we have now. So the women said, you needn't think you're going for that without me. And so they all came and they lined up way around the block to wait and come and shake his hand. So I knew that he had charisma, that the people liked him. They liked what they saw. So we had the party, and it was a great success. Everybody came, whether they were a delegate or not. If they heard about it, they came. So that was the beginning. And so Bobby had arranged all of this for him, and he was very, very grateful. So when 1960 came along, or 59, I guess, is when they started, Bobby had left the law firm at that point, and he said, okay, Jack, I can help you with this. And he said, Leonard Grinch, who was a great friend of ours, was head of that convention in Los Angeles. And he said, I could get Leonard to help me set it all up for you. He's been there before and he knows what he's doing. So he said, I'll go out there. So he spent, oh, 3 or 4 months out there. And he tied up everything. Could be all the hotel rooms he had. Had all that. And the cars, everything. I mean, and when old Lyndon Johnson got there, he just couldn't believe. And his, I've forgotten his man's name now, that was doing the same thing for him that Bobby was doing. But anyway, Bobby befriended him. And, you know, he said, look, we're in this together. Let's don't be enemies. Let's, you know. So he wasn't about to give him too much of the information, but he gave him some hotel rooms and some cars and that kind of thing. So they became friends. And then Leonard, of course, had talked with Jack Kennedy and told him some of the things to do and what not to do when you're on television, and how you project yourself to come across. So it was a fun thing for Bobby. He enjoyed that. And I think really it was the difference, because he spent it, the only thing was he kept saying, when are you going to come out here and pay some of these bills? Oh, don't worry, we'll be up. You know? And the bills kept going up and up.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it all worked out fine.
Well, this would be the Democratic Convention. In 1960
would have been the year when the convention failed, but he went out there and did it.
The end of that Johnson is the vice president.
Well, that's an interesting story, mm-hmm. because Kennedy did not like Lyndon Johnson, and the same Lyndon Johnson hated Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bobby said to him after he had gotten the nomination, who was going to be vice president. And Bobby said, look, you're a rich Catholic Yankee, and it's going to be hard to get all the votes in the South. You're going to have to balance this with somebody that is agreeable to the South if you want to win. Otherwise, you're an also ran. So they, after much ado, he decided he would take Lyndon Johnson.
Well, and they, Jeff Kennedy was a senator at that time, wasn't he?
He was a senator from Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I think every living human being that lives in the United States should have to go to a convention one time. You don't have to do it any more than once, uh-huh. but it is an eye-opener. So, anyway, that was the end of that. When the convention was over and things settled down, everybody's coming to the new president for what they wanted. And so he asked Bobby, what would you like then? Bobby said, I don't want anything. He never wanted anything for himself, ever. And he said, but I have a law partner who wants to be on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. That was Griffin Bell.
Mm-hmm.
Griffin had helped a little in Georgia, but he didn't. Wasn't
he the
Bobby said,
titular head of the campaign in Georgia, Griffin Bell?
I don't really remember. There were so many people.
Mm-hmm.
And Bobby was all over the South.
We're talking about the presidential campaign now.
Yeah. Well, anyway, he said, Griffin, I'm glad you didn't ask for the Supreme Court. So anyway, when he went to Kennedy and told him that he wanted this for Griffin Bell, Kennedy said, Lyndon Johnson's already given that spot to somebody, promised it. And Bobby said, that's all I want. So that's what he got. Griffin got the spot.
He got
the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals judge.
Yeah.
So, anyway, they became great buddies. Bobby had a lot of influence, and this is when he got the idea for Plans for Progress. He was a great person for background studies of everything. If you asked him a question, you'd get this much of a report back. You know. But he...
For the reporter's sake, you measured about 4 inches.
Well, he statistically, he was involved with everything. And that's when he got the Lockheed, because he had done this study,
mm-hmm.
saying, you cannot give all of these contracts to the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
Georgia has Lockheed, and they deserve to have this. And so he said, give me the background.
Mm-hmm.
Bobby writes this thing forevermore. Took 2 months or so to do it. And he said, no questions. They deserve it.
That was the affirmative action plan?
That was the giving that Lockheed the contract, the big contract that they got.
I understand.
Otherwise, they would have gone out of business.
The solution was the affirmative action plan, which became called a Plan for Progress.
I don't know whether that is so. I guess
yes, it is.
Was.
We
okay.
know that.
Okay.
I was personally involved in part of that.
Okay. Well, I know that, who was it was president who died in an automobile accident? It was the president of Lockheed at the time.
Tom May.
Tom May, yeah, that's right. And it's, of course, why we got most of the information, background stuff from him, you know, and to present this case to the president that we, we could not afford to lose all these jobs in Georgia, you know. We just had to have this contract, and so we got it. But anyway, then he got the idea. He started doing statistics on the black people in Georgia. And he found out, ye gods, they're all on welfare. We cannot afford this. It will bankrupt the country. Because they have all these children, and they are three and four generations into the welfare system. And you just can't, that would bankrupt any country. And he said, you've got to educate them, and we've got to give them job opportunities. So he did all this background study on that, and then went to Jack Kennedy about it, and told him, he said, I would like to go to the major corporations in the United States and present this presentation to them about what we have got to do. It's something that we have to do to be able to survive, because you can't have this many people on welfare and not anybody, I mean everybody that's working has to pay for that, and it's just too much. We can't afford it. So he did. He took all this time. The first, well, I would say up until the day Jack Kennedy was shot, he was still working night and day on the plans for progress. And when he was killed that day, I've never seen such a change in somebody. And the worst part was, he was very involved with all the Kennedy family at this point, and Steve Smith was the one who handled the money for the whole trust of the Kennedy family. And he was down here visiting us, and this, 3 or 4 years, I guess, after Kennedy was murdered. Or no, it was actually about 2 years, I guess. Because he was murdered in the middle of his first office as president. But they were talking about Bobby Kennedy, and my Bobby said, if he wants to be president, if he ever wants to be president, he's gonna have to run this time. Because the whole country was up here for Kennedy's, you know. And after you get another president, then they get out of the limelight. And so he said, if he wants it. And Steve said, well, I want you to go to Washington and talk to him about it.
This is talk to Bobby.
Bobby.
Yeah, Bobby Kennedy.
Okay, Bobby.
So he did. And then when Bobby was killed, that was a changing point in my husband's life. He just never was the same person after that. So he felt that he had contributed to both of their murders by encouraging them. And that's a terrible thing. And I said, Bobby, that's the most ridiculous thing. But he always felt that way, and there's no way that anybody could judge.
How did that manifest himself, his behavior?
I think finally, at the end of his life, he had Alzheimer's.
You think so?
Yes, I do. He never went to a doctor. Never would go to a doctor. And what happened was, he was in Florida with this land we have down there, and he got a bad mole here on his forehead. And I kept asking him, please go and see about that mole. You know, it just doesn't look good. Well, we went to a party at Chenault Haley's house. And Chenault said to him, I mean, I don't care who you go to, whether you come to me or anybody else, but you ought to see about that thing on your face. And so he would go to Florida on Monday and come back on Thursday. And so Friday I made an appointment and took him down there. I said, you're going to see about this thing on your face now. Well, it was melanoma cancer, and it had spread through his whole body. So,
what period of time was this?
He died in 1941.
Was this in 1941?
No, this was, he died in 1991. After the 60s, you know, after, I guess it was 64.
68 when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated.
68?
Yeah,
okay.
After that.
Well, that was the change when I noticed this tremendous change in him.
So you got the melanoma and what?
Melanoma cancer.
What year would you say that
was? Oh,
gosh, I don't know. Uh-huh. He'd been down there in Florida and on this land fighting those people to use his. First thing I remember in law school was a man has the right to use his land. And they would put roadblocks. We're still fighting them.
Well, what did he? Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to ask you. So during after Jack Kennedy was assassinated, then what did he do? What did he do when he sort of left?
Well, this is when he bought all this land in Florida. Okay. He was going to develop this new city. Down there, they had all this land. Scared those people to death down there. We was going to have it where they had, you know, the planned city like Peachtree City, you know, and you have a fire station and a school and a church and everything's organized and all.
The lawsuits still pending on that?
Oh, no. We finally solved things. We still have the land, but you've got to get it permitted. You know, and that's when they put the roadblocks in for you, you know.
Resident retirees had blocked it.
Oh, yeah. See, we had both sides of the land on the road going over to Sanibel. And all those people on Sanibel said, oh, you can't build on that land because if we have a hurricane, we got to get off of the island. You know, so we shouldn't use our land so they could get off of the island. But anyway, we're going to...
Go ahead.
Going back to the Kennedy campaign in the fall of 1960, I understand that everybody was involved in asking the Kennedys to call Coretta Scott King when he got in jail in Atlanta when Martin Luther King was jailed for a trivial thing. Can you recall that?
I recall it, yes, but I don't recall it clearly. I don't know who called who or what, but Bobby knew Martin Luther King. And he had met with him, you know, on this Plans for Progress and all. He met with all the black people in power here. And in fact, an interesting thing which shows you how people are. Riches was very, very good with inching ahead with the black people. The firm represented Riches. And so when they had some big push going on, the first target they chose was Riches. And Mr. Troutman, who represented the firm, and Riches, he was on the board of Riches, board of directors. And he said, why? We've always tried to give you every opportunity to advance. Why did you choose Riches as your target? They said, because you'd knuckle under first. That rib was a shocker.
Even after it's called the kingpin. If you knock down the kingpin, the rest of them will hook up. Lockheed was in the same thing, and I've heard an attorney, Russell Spector, when he had the NAACP case sued Lockheed in the 70s, and that's what he told me and our lawyers. He said, why do you choose the company, the corporation that has been the leader in the South in integration since the 50s? And Russell Spector said, well, if you knock down the kingpin, the rest of them will fall in line. And they figured they'd get some concessions from Lockheed that would scare everybody else. Sounds to me like it was pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, that's a theory.
Mm-hmm. It's ironic because there were so many who were so much who were doing, you know, mm-hmm. much worse, you know, and yet they picked the companies.
They picked
that
the leaders.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, the leaders that were inclined to compromise. Mm-hmm. I'm sure Richard.
They had too much to lose. Yeah.
Let me go back to the time when Jack Kennedy was a senator. Now I know that through Joe Cruz that when Plans for Progress was beginning and they were signing up these companies that Bobby and Joe Cruz were working together on, that there was opposition.
Oh yeah.
And Joe tells me, and we have a take from him on this too, that we, meaning he and Bobby, put the White House label on things that they were doing. So when they would say, let's do this and let's do this, they never knew, according to Joe, whether the president had approved it or not, that they gave the impression that, and they knew that Bobby Kennedy, this is, I'm quoting what Joe had said, that he had access to Kennedy. He could just walk past, what was the Secretary Lincoln, was that her name?
Mm-hmm. Evelyn Lincoln.
Evelyn Lincoln. And he could just, at any time, he always had access to the president. Mm-hmm. And everybody knew that. Does this ring a bell with you?
Mm-hmm.
And as Joe says, we use that for the certain issues that would have been controversial, could have had opposition, things they wanted to do, and to set up meetings with the private sector and promote plans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There was opposition, right, within the committee.
Oh, yes, and Bobby. Turn that off a minute, I'll tell you something.
Did you visit Kennedy and his offices? Was he close to him at that time?
Well, I wouldn't say close to him. They were, you know, the war was on. Mm-hmm. They had all kinds of things when we were in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
But then when, after the war was over and Kennedy was elected senator, Bobby wasn't up there that much,
right.
You
yeah.
see. Mm-hmm. So he would call on him when he was up there, and they kept in touch,
mm-hmm.
you know, like old friends, mm-hmm. you know. You mm-hmm. may not see somebody for 6 months or a year, but they're mm-hmm. still friends.
Right.
So, he got involved in the law practice down here, you mm-hmm. know, so his time was spent in the law firm.
Mm-hmm.
So, if he was in Washington, mm-hmm. he might call him and they'd have lunch or something, but
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
in fact, he took me to lunch one day, Jack Kennedy, and my mother.
Mm-hmm.
Made my mother's highlight of her life to have lunch with Jack Kennedy. Anyway, this is just lots of old memories.
Let's see, in 1961, you were living here on West
mm-hmm.
Wesley,
mm-hmm.
right? And Joe
mm-hmm.
Cruz was living
yeah.
in
and
a cottage.
He may have stayed down the little guest house we had in the back. It wasn't much of a guest house, but it was, you could inhabit it. Put it that way. It wasn't great. And not like some of the guest houses that mm-hmm. some of our friends had. But anyway, it was okay. And he had come to work for Bobby, I think through Bill Bond, who was from Florida also. Both of them came from St. Petersburg area. And Bill Bond married Leonard Wrench's daughter, and we were very close to the Wrenches, and so that made us close to Bill Bond. And I think it was through Bill Bond that Bobby found Joe Cruz. And Bill Bond didn't marry Penny until after the Plans for Progress thing, because he and Joe worked on both on the Plans for Progress.
I knew Bill Bond when he was with Cox.
Yes, he was with Cox, and then very sad story. He and Penny were divorced and had two fine boys. And I think Bill died mostly an alcoholic, from what I understand. I did not know him after that. But He was a good friend.
I lost track of him, but when I retired in 88, I got a letter from him. And I still have it on my file. I think it was right about that time.
Well, he was a good man, and I hated to see that, but mm-hmm. it's one of those things, yeah. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Divorce is so mm-hmm. prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we know from research that that Joe Cruz and Bobby arranged for 100 companies operating out of a place at Bobby's office in downtown and everything. Mm-hmm. They made all these arrangements for these companies to come to Washington, where the vice president, sometimes the president, would meet with these CEOs mm-hmm. from Fortune 500 companies, and they'd go back and write a plan for progress, a affirmative action plan that emulated the Lockheed plan.
Mm-hmm.
Each one was individually written. But Bobby's hand and Joe Cruz's hand was in that.
Oh, yeah.
And I happened to, I went up to Providence and brought back three boxes of Joe's records. In there is a deck of 3x5 cards with all the company contact names, the telephone numbers, and the running dialogue of the efforts to get them to come into Washington. And he and Bobby Troutman, he was doing a lot of the legwork.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But Bobby Troutman, he was the honcho of the all.
Yeah.
You
know, yeah.
And they worked together,
yeah.
Signed up the first 100 companies, and then Joe moved to Washington, and he became an employee of the Department of Labor.
I didn't know that.
Yes, he did. And he continued to work on the Plans for Progress program, was working mm-hmm. there. And then he was replaced with volunteer staff. And a friend of mine from Lockheed, Harold Lockwood, and four other men came in and ran the program that Joe Cruz and Bobby Troutman did. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you something sort of interesting. When I talked to Howard still in California, and a good friend of mine, Howard Lockwood. He worked for Lockheed in California.
Oh, I see.
And he spent a year in Washington as a part of the volunteer group that signed up ultimately 441 companies to Plans for Progress. So what Bobby started as one Lockheed became 441 affirmative action plans developed by those corporations, approved by the President's Committee, final signing just like Lockheed in the Vice President's office. And Kennedy was all involved in that until he died. So I told Howard, I didn't know at that time, I thought Howard developed this methodology.
Mm-hmm.
His plan of contacting the companies mm-hmm. and coordinate with John Peel, the President's Committee, who had to be a part of this thing. And they come into the White House, and we got pictures of all of these people in there with the Vice President in the East Room or the West Room, whichever it was, addressing them. So I thought Howard had developed this. And I told this to Joe Cruz. He says, he just copied what Bobby Troutman and I did. I said, well, I'm getting educated here. And that was before I had interviewed Bobby Troutman. Uh-huh. So I didn't know the details. So that's Bobby, yeah. Bobby's, that's his role in history that uh-huh. we're talking about.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. He became known as the father of Plans for Progress.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And in 18 months, that's all he was involved in this thing, was roughly, as you would know.
Yeah.
And when he resigned, it was from the start to finish, was no more than 18 months.
Yeah. Well,
and he did all of this to get it started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he devoted his entire life to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
I mean, you just cannot believe the amount of work that he
mm-hmm.
did.
But he got in this controversy, did he? That was talking
yeah,
about.
With, as I told you, the mm-hmm. two different camps,
mm-hmm.
one the Kennedy camp and mm-hmm. one the
Johnson camp. Mm-hmm.
And the funny part about it was that we had had an artist that we had that came to stay with us to do my portrait. He stayed for 2 years, I think. And so Bobby, to get him out of the house and all, he sent him to Washington. He did a portrait of Kennedy and a portrait of Lyndon Johnson. Well, this was before the big hassle. Bobby could see Lyndon Johnson's stripes, and so I was stuck with his portrait. So when I moved from West Wesley, I said, I don't want Lyndon Johnson. So I gave him to my brother.
Uh-huh.
And my brother said, you know, I really don't want him either. I think I'll contact the people in Texas for the
Johnson Barber.
And see if they want it. So they said, oh, yes, they would like to have it. So I said, give it to them. I don't want it.
Did Bobby pay for that?
Oh, yeah, Bobby paid for all these things.
So Lyndon Johnson's portrait, paid for by Bobby, is in the Lyndon Johnson Library in Austin, Texas?
That's right. It may have had a big crack down the middle of it or something. I don't know.
There's some dart hole.
Anyway, they sent a man, my brother had moved from Atlanta to Tennessee, and they sent a truck. He said it was the biggest moving van he had ever seen in his life
to move a pig.
So anyway, I guess they were collecting things all along the way to go to Texas.
I think it's interesting that it's there.
Yes, it is.
And I'm in touch with the librarian, the archivist at the
shot,
library.
Get a picture, a photo of that. That would be interesting.
Yeah, really.
Classic.
Terry Allen is his name. He's the archivist at the LBJ Library in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have to talk to him about that.
Yeah, just tell him.
That's a good one.
It was after I was remarried too, that so it would. The letter or whatever connected. They sent me something, then I had to sign, all this.
Something.
Good riddance.
Authorizing, yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That was not included in the will, but it required your approval, huh?
Yeah, I guess so.
I was just kind of curious. I've been sitting here thinking, and it just occurs to me, I wonder what could you tell us about what Bobby Troutman and or any of his associates at the law firm or his dad, or how did they feel about the civil rights movement, about that the race issue that became such a major part of American life in the 50s and the 60s, and the Kennedy administration had that. They had Southern supporters, but then again, they also were playing to the civil rights. So how did that work, and how did he feel about that? What was his attitude about it?
Well, I think Bobby and his father and his family all saw the handwriting on the wall, that we have to do something with this, or it's going to be like a cancer and will eat us away.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to give people an opportunity. If they see no light at the end of the tunnel, that's the reason their jails were full and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So he preached this,
mm-hmm.
and people began to see the light, that this was something that was a major problem, mm-hmm. and we were going to have to cope with it, because it was, when there were a few slaves on the plantation, it didn't matter, but now you have Atlanta's population is more than 50% now.
Yeah.
So the point is, you just have to deal with those things. And I think people understood once they saw his statistics and how things were going, they could see that there was this was not going to wait.
Do you think it hurt him at all in making his case that with some of the critics, that he was a white Southerner who was proposing these things? Do you think that there were some folks who just that it didn't matter what he said, they were going to discount it because he's a white Southerner and therefore he must have another agenda? Do you think that was a part of it?
Bobby refused to talk to the media
for
a long, long time, and finally one day, people from the New York Times called him. And he thought, if anybody's going to be honest, I think they will probably be honest.
Mm-hmm.
So he gave them a long interview, told them all his plans and everything. And they said, Mr. Troutman, he said, at Lockheed, they have restrooms for blacks and restrooms for whites. And Bobby said, I don't care where they go to the bathroom. I want to get them a job. And so the newspaper came out with saying that Mr. Troutman did not object to separate restrooms.
Yeah, I think we have a copy of that article.
Yeah.
He was so mad. He said, I'll never talk to another one of those people. Because they changed the whole thing.
Right.
All the hour or more that he talked to the people.
And that was all that was the most important thing.
Yeah.
And to him, that was just almost a joke. He was just saying, look, I don't really care about that. I mean, yeah, I know. Yeah.
That's still going on.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh,
they're terrible. I don't ever want to talk to them about anything.
There's a story in today's paper about they interviewed all these women and wives of these soldiers over there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. It's
that
stirring
the
pot.
That is the most one-sided story you ever saw.
Oh, yes.
You know, it
makes me so mad.
And then it was all standing. There's something I wanted to ask you, though, about. There was another thing that Bobby was known as a practical joker.
Oh, my word. He was indeed the original, I think.
Joe Cruz had several stories to tell. There's one that's sort of in that blank that turned out to be unfortunate for him. We have an article from one of the New York papers, Times Herald or something like that. There was this reception for Talmadge and I don't know who else was there, whether Russell was there or what, but they were all of the known politicians who were strict segregationists. Voted against the Civil Rights Act of 64, and would not provide budget to the President's Committee back in 61, 62, and 63. Tied their hands up. And that's a part of our history, that while the compulsory side, the ideology of the compulsory side being stronger than they were was not unsound. The problem was they didn't have the lawyers, they didn't have the budget, and over here it's Bobby Troutman and Joe Cruz, and we're moving ahead with the voluntary side. And Randy's going to do some research to get statistics to show that most of the integration that occurred during this breakthrough period, critical breakthrough period, where there was strong political opposition in the South, was going leaps and bounds, not exactly statistically, but companies changed their policies.
And they did it voluntarily.
And they did it voluntarily. Mm-hmm. And then they started the process of integration, which took time.
Yeah.
Not because of the deliberate speed, it's just the lack of qualification.
You can get more flies with sugar than you can with salt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you tell somebody, you've got to do this, the back goes up.
Yeah.
You know, but if you explain to him why they
Bobby
have to do this, he was very good at this. He was very good at
explaining. You know, heard of Don Hollowell, civil rights attorney, the integrated
community. Oh, yeah, black man.
Black man. Black was a Don Hollowell, the Hollowell Street in Atlanta. He's in poor health, and I have talked to him recently. And he said essentially the same thing, the same philosophy that Bobby Troutman had. He says, there's the law and then the way to work with the law. Hollowell, like Bobby Troutman, was a negotiator. And he won his battles outside court.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that was pretty much what...
Everybody loses in court,
you
know.
Yeah.
As they say, the lawyers get rich.
One of the stories that's in the paper that backfired on Bobby was the this reception I'm talking about, in which they invited all these friends of these segregationist politicians. And Bobby was arranging the invitation. And this is out of this New York paper. And they told him they should be integrated. And that was his guidance on this thing. Well, it turns out the press found out there were no blacks that came, okay? And they asked Bobby about this, and he said, well, we invited Indians, people of color. I take it that was his sense of humor, but it did backfire.
Well, the point is, you don't alienate people. Now, Herman Talmadge was a very close friend. Bobby stayed with them most of the time when he was in Washington, you know. And when they had their house, and then when they went into an apartment, they always had a room for Bobby. Mm-hmm. And they were very close friends. Herman says, you know, Bobby, I'm going to go with you as long as I can, but I have to get reelected. Mm-hmm. And so that's the politics mm-hmm. of all of it, you mm-hmm. know. Mm-hmm. If you don't get elected, you also ran.
Mm-hmm. About 30 to 35% of the Southern congressmen voted against the Civil Rights Act of '64, mm-hmm. and that's exactly what Henry mm-hmm. Thomas was saying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had his constituents
voted against it. So that was what Bobby was dealing with, the Southern
right.
political segregationist culture.
Right. Well, it's the general people and mm-hmm. that I'll go to the polls. I go to the polls, you go to the polls. Mm-hmm. You think one way, I cancel your vote, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. So what good if you don't get the people back home that vote for you mm-hmm. to believe in what you're doing, mm-hmm. then you're going
to
be...
This sort of gets to the question that Randy just posed, though. Being a Southerner, being so close to the segregationist politicians, it must have been viewed as questioning his sincerity in this.
Well, you can do a lot of questioning, but you never question his sincerity because he...
Well, I didn't mean we were. I meant the people at the time, probably a lot of the civil rights leaders would, because he was a Southerner and knew Talmadge and knew, then they would question his sincerity. Yeah, that's what we meant.
He came from a family, as I told you, his grandfather was a Methodist minister. And one of the problems that people have who think ahead are the people who don't want to think, period. You know, they want it status quo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so this is, his family was a family that moved ahead. Mm-hmm. His grandfather had an experience that they had a Mr. Troutman's older brother, and there were four boys in the family, and he was at Georgia Tech. And Mr. Troutman had a very close friend with a rabbi and with a Catholic priest. And they used to get together and talk over their religious beliefs and so forth. And the word got out, and they wanted to get Mr. Troutman thrown out of his, however they call mm-hmm. that. Being a minister. And this boy that was at Georgia Tech came home and got off the streetcar, and another one was coming down mm-hmm. and hit him and killed him. Mm-hmm. And the people in his congregation said, God's punished you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, you see, this is the kind of family that they came from, that they were forward-thinking people. You don't stay in the status quo. You got to move ahead or you slip behind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So his grandmother started the first farmer's market in Athens, and she was blind.
Mm-hmm.
But she organized it, and she had those farmers who were grazing these crops and didn't have any place to sell them, mm-hmm. and she had raised this herb market in Athens mm-hmm. for these people to come in and sell their products,
mm-hmm.
and it was a great success.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
so, I mean, they were that kind of a family. Of they mm-hmm. moved ahead. They mm-hmm. saw a problem, and they moved ahead mm-hmm. to try and solve it.
Bobby appeared to be very venturesome, and one of his ventures was the air rights to the over the railroad.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that, what you know
well,
about it?
I better watch what I say about that. Bobby had the idea that New York, half of New York, has railroads running underneath of it. And here's Atlanta. We need to utilize all the space that we can. And so he went to the different railroads and got this contract for 100 years for the air rights over the property. everybody thought he had lost his mind. I mean, what are you going to do over in the air? Well, he didn't have the money to develop it. I mean, that takes a lot. Mm-hmm. And so he got with Tom Cousins. And he held it for quite a while, and he thought, well, he had a disagreement with Southern Railroad. They were going to back it. And then when Bobby got the Big John car passed by, Jack Kennedy intervened, saying, because the truck people fought them tooth and nail. They did not want the railroads to have that Big John car, because that was going to, they had king
John
of the car. Road, you know.
What do you mean, John car?
Pardon me?
John.
John car, what do you mean?
They called it the, what did I call it? Just the Big John car, I think is what it was. It was a huge, very large railroad car, which was much bigger than what they were allowed to use. Mm-hmm. And so they came up with this idea of having this Big John, I think is what they called it.
Okay.
And so the railroad people came, Southern Railroad, came to Bobby and said, you know, can you help us try and get the approval of this? And so he said, well, let me make a study. So as usual, he made all this grand study, and then he went to Washington and he got that approved. And they said, if you get this approved for us, we'll go forward with doing the yes, land over the air rights.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't do it. Said, oh no, that's not going to be feasible. We're not going to be able to do that. After he had, and Uncle Henry and his law firm had already tried to go to Washington and get this approved for him, and they couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So Uncle Henry called Bobby up and said, look, Bobby, we sent him a bill for, I don't know how much money was involved, and we didn't do anything. We couldn't get it done. Don't you dare send them a bill for anything less than that.
Mm-hmm.
So Bobby said, well, if they work with me on the air rights, you know, we'll forget about that.
Mm-hmm.
When they turned him down on the air rights after they had promised, I mean, I don't think there was anything in writing, but a man's honor is at stake when he pledges something. And so Bobby sent them a bill, what Uncle Henry told him to send. And so, no, they weren't going to pay that bill.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, you're going to go to court with them. I said, you've done the work, you got the job done, and they owe you that money. So we got Billy Schroeder to represent him, and they sued for the money.
Sued the railroads?
Sued the railroads.
Wasn't the Georgia State Legislature involved? Didn't they have to authorize that?
I don't think so. I don't know anything about that.
Well, it was approved.
You mean the air rights?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. He got that. He got the air rights for 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what do you do with air off if you can't build something on it, you know?
So
I mean, look at New York. I mean, good Lord.
Yeah.